From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Big news, President Trump accepts North Korea's Kim Jong-un's sudden offer to meet. Also this week, President Trump defies critics on both sides of the aisle, including Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, and officially orders tariffs on imported steel and aluminum.
A strong steel and aluminum industry are vital to our national security. Absolutely vital. Steel is steel. You don't have steel, you don't have a country.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says Wednesday that the Trump administration is suing the state of California over its so-called sanctuary city laws.
California, we have a problem. A series of actions and events has occurred here that directly and adversely impact the work of our federal offices.
Former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg subpoenaed by Robert Mueller. Would he comply was the question as Nunberg made the rounds Monday on cable TV. Here he is with MSNBC's Katie Turr.
Are you worried about getting arrested?
I think it would be funny if they arrested me.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Talib of Bloomberg News, Natasha Bertrand of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the news on the North Korea meeting? Are you betting with President Trump on tariffs? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Margaret Talib, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, it's always great to have you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also joining us via Skype today from Washington is Natasha Bertrand, staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers national security. Natasha, thank you so much for being with us today as well.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, it is such a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Meghna. Margaret, hello. Natasha, hello.
All right. Well, so let's start off, if we can, with the giant news from the White House about President Trump agreeing to meet with Kim Jong-un. Last night, South Korea's national security advisor, Chung Oh-young, said that President Trump agreed to this meeting to discuss denuclearization. Here's the announcement, which took place at the White House.
President Trump appreciated the briefing and said he would meet Kim Jong-un by May to achieve permanent denuclearization.
Margaret, if it weren't stunning enough that a South Korean national security advisor were making an announcement on behalf of the President of the United States on a historic meeting, I mean, that's just the beginning here. What's your reaction to this decision by Donald Trump?
It was absolutely a stunning turn of events over the period of a couple of hours yesterday afternoon, beginning with President Trump himself making a very rare pop into the briefing room to let anybody in shouting range hear that there was going to be very big news to be announced around 7 o'clock, set off a mad scramble, and that's just prologue to what unfolded afterwards. But you're right, it is it was a very unusual announcement on two parts. And the first was that the envoy for another country, for South Korea, is standing outside of the White House at the sticks, is what we call it, by those microphones outside of the entrance to the West Wing, making this announcement about what the U.S. Mm-hmm. and North Korea would do. And then, of course, that would seem like the hugest deal in the world, if not for the fact that it was instantly eclipsed by what is happening,
right,
in fact, which is this meeting. The meeting is incredibly important on a number of notes. One is because of how the level of tension in recent months on the peninsula, of course. The other is because of how advanced North Korea's program seems. The third is because, at least as President Trump and his team read it, this is a sign that the sanctions are, in fact, having a major impact. And that is what has essentially forced Kim to go to South Korea and say, could you please make this meeting happen? Now, that's one way to read it. The other way to read it is that this is some sort of a ruse or a ploy, that President Trump is at risk of getting played, that he has very little foreign policy experience, that Kim is never going to denuclearize, yada, yada, yada. Uh-huh. And so the table is set.
Yeah. Natasha, I mean, this has never happened with a sitting president of the United States. And you know, as Margaret laid out there, I can definitely see on the one hand, President Trump, you know, a strong-minded leader, thinks that he can, you know, read directly and talk directly to another obviously strong-minded leader across the table. But this is unprecedented for so many reasons. I mean, why would the United States enter a conversation like this when we have extracted no real meaningful concessions from South Korea just yet?
Right. I think that's the big question. And, you know, we saw Rex Tillerson say yesterday that the U.S. is actually a very long way from negotiations. He actually said, we're not negotiating. We're just going to be talking. No one was quite sure what that meant. But I think that he's trying to draw a very clear distinction between the idea of, you know, sitting down with North Korea and giving them these concessions when they really haven't given us anything in return, and starting a conversation with the North Koreans, which is, of course, something that is unprecedented and needs to be handled very, very delicately. You know, Tillerson said that they have to meet face-to-face with the representatives of North Korea, whether or not the conditions are even right to begin thinking about it. So it really remains to be seen whether or not Trump has, you know, allies in his among his national security advisors who, you know, are on board with this kind of negotiation or talks, as Rex Tillerson said.
And if he doesn't, I mean, if the president doesn't have allies amongst his own national security advisors, but plows ahead with this, I mean, what could be the potential consequences?
Well, as we've seen in the past, I mean, Trump kind of marches to the beat of his own drummer. I mean, if he were to not kind of pursue these negotiations with the North Koreans, then that might cause, you know, further tension with South Korea and China. South Korea, as we've seen, has kind of taken really the lead on kind of thawing the relations with North Korea. If you'll remember, all of this began, of course, when South Korea invited the North Koreans to the Olympics. So it kind of, we just need to see how this is going to play out. But as of right now, you know, experts are, you know, cautiously optimistic about the direction this is headed in.
Wow. Jack, I've been waiting all morning to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I noted that the South Korean National Security Advisor was careful, as President Moon has been, to give President Trump credit, a lot of credit for this. That is crucial to enlist the Trumpian ego in the enterprise of meeting with Kim. You know, there are things that just sketching down that could derail this or make this the promise of this stillborn. One is the Iran nuclear agreement. It's coming up in May. I think the president has to certify it again. Will he? If he doesn't, if he breaks from that, well, that can tell the North Koreans that we don't keep our promises on these matters, and that could severely hurt any prospects. Second, we're about to launch a trade war with China on intellectual property. We're about to do it alone because the Europeans won't be in it. Will China continue to be in our corner? And third, John Bolton. Five sources have told NBC that McMaster, the National Security Advisor, is leaving soon, and John Bolton was seen in the White House this week. If that Rufus Hawk is appointed a National Security Advisor, well, a former aide to John Kerry tweeted the other day, if Bolton goes in, we're all dead.
Well, obviously, there is much more to discuss on this surprise announcement of a meeting, and will be discussed in the coming days, if not weeks. But let's turn now to another big story from the White House. And this is, again, just yesterday. Despite opposition from within his own party, and obviously lots of pushback from allies abroad, President Trump did sign a bill, a new order imposing new tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum, temporarily exempting Canada and Mexico, though. So here's President Trump during the announcement.
We want to build our ships. We want to build our planes. We want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem.
Margaret Talib, the president of the United States and some of his supporters definitely see this as a win for him and a win for the steel industry in the United States. But overall, I mean, is it a win for him?
Well, the answer to that question really is what happens next. I mean, already this was pretty dramatically scaled back, or at least off ramps provided compared with what the initial posture on this tariff arrangement was. But there's still a lot of concern and consternation from Western allies, from the EU. But Canada and Mexico are taken care of. There's exemptions on national security grounds. So, you know, what happens next internationally, what the pushback is, may have consequences for the U.S. economy and as a result, political consequences for the president if The goal is to message to some of the key groups in the base and in certain states, then it is, at least in the near term, a victory for him because he said he was going to do this and he did it. But if the goal is to take maximum advantage of that tax plan, the tax overhaul that was passed, and to try to keep the markets, moving forward, then I think to be determined is the best answer.
Yeah. And of course, we're starting to hear things like Brazil saying that it may not buy U.S. coal as retaliation for these tariffs because Brazil makes a bit of steel as well. Natasha Bertrand, of course, the president used national security reasoning to make this decision. Congress could have introduced legislation to stop it, but it didn't. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the tariff plan has already angered a number of U.S. allies, including Mexico, Canada, Britain, and members of the EU. And they all argue that their exports to the U.S. obviously don't pose a threat to national security. And some have already threatened retaliatory tariffs on products like, whiskey and Harley-Davidson motorcycles. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that Republicans in Congress have kind of just decided to fall in line with this. That's obviously a pattern that we've seen them do in the past when it comes to legislation introduced by the president or moves introduced by the president. So this is, it wasn't necessarily surprising that they've chosen to go along with it. But like Margaret said, I think we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
Jack, I'm sorry, just going to give Jack a quick swing at this because we've got about 30 seconds here before the break. Jack, go ahead.
Well, it was launched with the usual Trump accompaniment of distortions and I'm trying not to say lies. He for example, he asserted that we have large trade deficits with Canada. Actually, we have a small surplus. He said Europe has massive tariffs on us. No, in fact, according to our own reports, the EU enjoys an average tariff of just 3%. Typical Trump.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new 6-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a show where people gather to speak freely. You might learn something new, hear things that challenge you, and on Friday, we review the week's top stories. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about quite a week in the news. There are new and some strange developments in the Russia probe and more chaos amongst White House senior staffers. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the news that President Trump has been asking witnesses what they may have told Robert Mueller? Did you catch the cable TV appearances from former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg? My guests today are Margaret Taleb, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, Natasha Bertrand, staff writer at The Atlantic covering national security, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Margaret, before the break, you just wanted to have another little say about tariffs there, and I had to cut you off, but what was your thought?
Well, we were talking about the notion about the national security, whether the steel import relations pose national security threats and the U.S. allies' posture. And I just wanted to point out that in some cases, like in the U.K., for example, some of the specialized steel that they import is actually used in defense contracts to protect U.S. national security. So when they're talking about exemptions for allies, it's not just that we want to take care of our allies because it boosts national security overall, but that, in fact, in some cases, there's actually specialized metals that are imported that the DOD relies upon for our technology.
Well, it's really interesting because the way that the announcement about these tariffs has played out over time just really is, once again, sort of a lens into how the White House operates and the level of, I don't know if we can call it functional chaos, but that's going on inside the Trump White House, because this tariff news did lead to the announcement of a resignation from economic advisor Gary Cohn. On Tuesday, he announced his resignation and President Trump tweeted on that same day, there's no chaos in the White House, but he'd also like to see some personnel changes. And later that day, a reporter asked the president during a joint press conference with the Swedish prime minister, and the president said, everyone wants to work in his White House.
I have a choice of anybody. I could take any position in the White House, and I'll have a choice of the 10 top people having to do with that position. Everybody wants to be there. And they love this White House because we have energy like rarely before.
Margaret, this is your ground. I mean, what do you make of what the president said?
Well, it's certainly not true that everybody wants to work in this White House, but there are people who do want to work in this White House, and there are people who have stayed in this White House kind of despite against all conventional wisdom and all odds. And Gary Cohn's case is an interesting and really instructive case, I think. On the one hand, there's no other way to read the timing of his announcement of his planned departure than to see that he was trying to send a signal to some audience about what his breaking point was. But on the other hand, it's also true that Gary Cohn had been thinking for several months about his departure, and particularly once the tax overhaul was accomplished. If you are a Democrat and a Wall Street guy and a billionaire, then to stay in the Trump administration, there must be some larger reason to do that. And Gary Cohn and the president had been talking for more than a month about what his next steps would be. If he were to stay on, he would want to take on a much larger role. What does that mean? Perhaps some kind of cabinet secretary job, perhaps some sort of other, you know, high-level job. They never found what that job could be. There weren't any openings, and it was not clear what the president could do to convince him to stay long-term. Having said that, could he have stayed another month? Could he have stayed till June? Certainly. And the decision to leave at precisely this pivot point seems to me to have been a pretty clear signal.
Yeah.
To somebody, perhaps outside the White House, that he had done what he had come to do, and it was time to go.
Jack Beatty, you know, we're also looking at a White House that's had so far an historic amount of senior staff turnover.
Yes, the Brookings Institute did a study of it. What was it? Out of all proportion, 43% higher than any other administration,
right.
I believe was the figure. You know, Mr. Cohn, his resignation is. It is worth comment. He wrote out, according to reporters, a letter of resignation after the Charlottesville, after the president made his moral equivalency between the neo-Nazis shouting, "The Jews will not replace us," and the peaceful demonstrators at Charlottesville. After the president made that moral equivalence, Cohn was ready to resign. He didn't. That was a clear issue of moral principle. Instead, he saved his indignation for the tariff. And I note that when in leaving, Trump's language is worth a look here. He says of Cohn, he may be a globalist, but I still like him. Mm-hmm. But he's also a nationalist because he loves our country. People have pointed out globalist and nationalist are two alt-right anti-Semitic tropes, and there's the president using them.
Wow. Well, let's take a call here. Mike is calling from Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Mike.
Hello. It's basically, we're dealing with the appointment procedures that we have for his staff. Is it on us, who appointed the people? He selects them, true, but we have to appoint them. And who we have appointed have not been the stellar people. So the initial bit was, we have to thoroughly investigate them. And it was, you know, or you could look at it as a resist movement, however you want to. But what comes out of these people that do show up are they're not the stellar. We need to have somehow better either his selection or our Congress picking.
Okay, Mike, so is your question about the sort of efficacy of the congressional confirmation process?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay. Okay, so Mike, thank you so much for your call. Margaret, I'm not quite sure to read how Mike's saying, what Mike's saying, but, you know, maybe looking for what's the source of the fact that there has been so much turnover and maybe the president hasn't yet found the right people for the job. I'm not quite sure how you read that.
Well, there are, of course, positions that need to be confirmed by the Senate, and the positions inside the White House that are just appointments that the president can choose who he wants. There is no confirmation process. So, you know, those are kind of two separate processes. But look, this is all White House jobs are high burnout jobs, but working in the Trump administration has a particularly special quality to it, because if you are high enough profile or are viewed as enough of a, you know, leader or kind of a challenge to the president's own primacy or power base, he tends to, you know, go after his own. We've seen it with Rex Tillerson. We've seen it with John Kelly. At some point, there were glowing profiles about H.R. McMaster in those early months, and President Trump sought to cut him down a size. So part of it is a pattern where the president often challenges the people that he brought into his circle and has the ability to weaken them, and then they have to kind of dig out. And so there are a lot of interesting power dynamics that are kind of special to this administration that, you know, you didn't see typically play out under President Obama or President Bush. And that adds a degree of complication. And then, of course, there's just the president's kind of the tweets, some of the polarizing nature of some of these events, and the fact that sometimes these policies, whether it's on North Korea or tariffs, the president just sort of bypasses his own team's processes, says what he wants to do, and everybody has to scramble.
Exactly.
And if you're one of the officials or advisors who's not on board with the approach, you ask yourself on at least a weekly basis, am I serving a real function here?
Yeah. Well, I want to switch gears, if we can, to news on the Russia investigation, because there has been so much news on this front this week. Former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg made dramatic appearances on cable news on Monday, saying he would refuse to go before a grand jury. He was subpoenaed by Robert Mueller to talk about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Now, he has since said he'll comply with the subpoena and will testify before the grand jury today. But on Monday, his interview with CNN's Erin Burnett ended awkwardly, if I could put it that way, when she asked whether or not Nunberg had been drinking before the interview.
So I just, because it is the talk out there, again, I know it's awkward, let me just give you the question. Well, you can categorically answer that. Have you had a drink today?
My answer is no, I have not.
Anything else?
No.
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 Natasha Bertrand, that was just one of the multiple things that happened on the Russia front this week. We have Paul Manafort pleading not guilty again. Story of Emirates involvement, the spy being poisoned in the UK. I mean, help us wrap our heads around all that's happened here.
Yeah, so, gosh, the Sam Nunberg piece seems like it was weeks ago now.
Right.
But he, you know, he came out on cable news on Monday, and he was giving, you know, a series of interviews explaining that he was going to rip up the subpoena that he had been issued by Mueller, and that he was not going to testify, and that he was not going to hand over the documents that Mueller wanted, because it would have been too time-consuming for him to do so, essentially. He just did not want to take the time to sift through all the emails. Now, of course, the underlying reason, which, you know, interviewers eventually got him to acknowledge, was that he did not want to testify or have to testify against his longtime mentor, Roger Stone. He is very, very close to Stone. And what we got from those interviews that number gave was that Mueller is very interested in what Roger Stone knew about the WikiLeaks releases during the 2016 election. Did he have advanced knowledge? Was it coordinated in any way with the campaign? Did he serve as kind of a liaison? So these are all things that Mueller presumably believes Nunberg would have had a window into, because he and Roger Stone are, of course, very close. Then with regard to the other news that came out this week, oh, and of course, Nunberg has since agreed to testify.
Right.
He appeared before the grand jury today. So that all kind of went up in smoke. But with regard to the other news that came out this week about, you know, potential further obstruction of justice by the president, the New York Times reported that Trump has been asking his aides what they've been discussing with Robert Mueller in these interviews, which, of course, you know, is very frowned upon. His, you know, White House counsel, Don McGahn, has been advising him not to do that. His lawyers have been telling him, you know, you're really not supposed to talk about the investigation with anyone. And then there was a really striking part of the Times piece, which basically said that he asked Don McGahn to come out and say that a New York Times piece that was published back in January, in which McGahn said that Mueller, in which McGahn told Mueller that Trump had tried to fire him or had ordered the special counsel to be fired last year. Trump actually threatened McGahn and said, you know, that if he did not change that testimony, if he did not come out and publicly deny it, then his job could be in jeopardy. Now, many legal experts have said that that might be tantamount to witness tampering, but, you know, some have said that it doesn't necessarily go that far. But this is just another example of the president kind of feeling squeezed by all this and wanting to be in control of everything that people close to him are telling the special counsel.
Natasha, can I just jump in here? Because I'm listening very intently to everything you're saying, because it seems as if the onslaught of the news on Russia this week has been kind of unyielding, right? There's so much depth to each one of the stories you're talking about. But I'm also just wondering how much of what we've discovered this week or heard helps us understand, if at all, the direction that Robert Mueller's investigation is going.
Yeah, definitely. So we, because of Sandberg's kind of antics on Monday, we learned that Mueller is, you know, really interested in learning more about what Roger Stone knows about WikiLeaks and everything. We also learned, so that's a potential collusion aspect. And we also learned that he is investigating this meeting in the Seychelles that happened in January of 2017 between a close, Trump ally, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, and Emiratis, and a Russian fund manager. So that's another, you know, episode where we can see that Mueller is actively investigating whether there was any kind of improper coordination or communication between Trump's associates and the Russians. So whereas we were getting a lot of news out of the Mueller probe regarding potential obstruction of justice, because that's been a very public-facing thing. I mean, Trump has not been shy about, you know, expressing his opinion about the Russian investigation. We hadn't been getting a lot of signals as to whether or not Mueller was still investigating the, you know, potential collusion that happened between the Trump campaign and Russia. And now that we know that he has actually gathered evidence to suggest that this meeting in the Seychelles was an effort to establish a back channel between Trump associates and the Kremlin, we're now seeing even more evidence that Mueller is actively investigating the collusion aspect.
Jack Beatty, your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's another big Russia-connected piece of news this week, and that is about Mitt Romney. Jane Mayer, in her stellar reporting in The New Yorker, has Christopher Steele, the dirty dossier author, coming out with another memo late last year saying that Russia had interfered with the Trump transition to prevent Mitt Romney's being Secretary of State. He only had one source for that. But today's Wall Street Journal is reporting that in fact, Russian-backed trolls at the were flooding social media with anti-Romney agitprop in an effort to derail his nomination right around the same time, calling him that epithet again, globalist puppet, staging calling for a demonstration in front of Trump Tower, and spreading a petition to have his nomination blocked. Well, that is just when Jane Mayer wrote it, it looked like, well, that's a remote and unlikely scenario. Well, here we hear Russian trolls were actually chipping in on that side.
Wow. Well, let's take a quick call here before the break. Michael is calling from Rockaway, New York. You're on the air, Michael.
Hey, Magna, how are we doing?
I'm doing great.
Okay, just real quick, with all the chaos and turmoil that's going on in the White House right now, I think what's being lost in translation is what's going on in the middle class. There appears to be a lock and stagflation coast to coast, and that's getting lost in all this turmoil. I was just wondering how you could address that.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for your call. Margaret Taleb, I mean, I think this is something that a lot of people feel, that the chaos, if that's what we're going to call it, in the White House is maybe a continuing distraction from the major issues facing the country.
Well, and the economy is always the major issue day to day in the way we all live. And then come election time, in general elections, tends to be the case. So I think we have a scenario here where the president has put a lot of his political eggs in the economic basket, the idea that tax reform was going to bring people, middle-class Americans, real relief, the idea that his steps on curbing the Affordable Care Act, the legacy of Obamacare, were going to give people more readily available, cheaper, better health insurance, the idea that the markets had grown so much during the course of his first year in office. In many ways, the time period between now and November is going to be a referendum on those propositions. And
well, let me just jump in here, though, because we do have job numbers today, right? That 313,000 jobs were added last month, the most since October 2015, unemployment staying at 4.1%. Some more sort of economic news today.
That's right. And those job numbers are good. They are unmistakably good.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, the economy behaves in mysterious ways, and a lot of everything from the tariff proposals to some of the foreign policy volatility have an ability to turn the boat on these things pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, we are discussing a big week in the news, and I know it feels like we say that every week, but it's true. And helping us to discuss it is Margaret Taleb, Natasha Bertrand, and Jack Beatty as well. After the break, we'll talk about the Trump administration suing California over that state's sanctuary protections. And former porn star Stormy Daniels suing the President of the United States. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In other news this week, late night host Trevor Noah poked fun at the high turnover in the White House.
The White House staff is just John Kelly and a fax machine that Jared isn't allowed to use. You know, right now, the White House has lost so many people. Like, every week, somebody's leaving. And, like, forget the White House. If an Applebee's lost this many people, I'd think twice about eating there.
Well, also, back in 1954, British athlete Roger Bannister was the first person to run a mile in under 4 minutes. Roger Bannister died this week at the age of 88.
Up to the finishing line. Time, 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds. Shattering the 4-minute mile, the Everest of athletic achievement. A great reception for the young medical student who had cut 2 whole seconds off Gunter Hag's world record set up 9 years ago.
And at last weekend's Oscars, Jordan Peele became the first black screenwriter to win an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for his movie Get Out. Here's his acceptance speech.
I stopped writing this movie about 20 times because I thought it was impossible. I thought it wasn't going to work. I thought no one would ever make this movie. But I kept coming back to it because I knew if someone let me make this movie, that people would hear it and people would see it.
We are talking about the week in the news. My guests today are Margaret Taleb, Natasha Bertrand, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. There's one more piece of tape I want to play regarding all the news surrounding Russia this week. This is Mark Rowley with the UK's Metropolitan Police. He said yesterday that former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his 33-year-old daughter were poisoned by a nerve agent, and the incident is being treated as an attempted murder.
Having established that a nerve agent is the cause of the symptoms, leading us to treat this as attempted murder, I can also confirm that we believe the two people originally who became unwell were targeted specifically.
We should say that now more than 20 people have been treated as a result of this attack. Let's turn to Rick, who's calling from Park Falls, Wisconsin. Rick, I know you want to talk a little bit about the Russian use, alleged use of nerve agents.
Yes, I do. President Bill Clinton went 18 separate times to visit President Putin and helped to legitimize Putin as the president of Russia amongst Western countries. But President Putin, I believe, is a mass murderer. He is the former head of the Russian secret police, the FSB. He has had many of his prominent critics in Russia killed, including Galina Starovoycheva, who was actually a member of the Russian Duma and who attempted to run for the Russian presidency. I believe he had Alexander Litvinenko murdered in London back in 2006 by using a rare substance called polonium.
That's right.
Yes, which is only produced in one place in the world, a city in Russia called Stavrova, I believe. And now this other case with these people in Surrey, England, I don't believe the daughter of this man was a spy. He may have been a former spy. But Putin has been systematically reaching out beyond the borders of Russia to murder people, to silence his critics.
Rick, I'm going to take it back from you there. Natasha Bertrand, your thoughts. Rick sees Putin as getting too bold.
Yeah, and this is going to present a real challenge, I think, to the British government yet again in terms of how to respond to the Russians. I mean, this is something that they have become known for, unfortunately, and they're not necessarily, you know, it's especially harsh when they think of people as traitors. So, for example, Litvinenko or now Sergei Skripal, these are people who were embedded in Russia's security services, in the intelligence services, who then kind of started, who turned on Russia. And they are ultimately treated with the harshest kind of punishment by the Kremlin. In terms of Clinton kind of legitimizing Vladimir Putin, of course, Vladimir Putin came into power in 1999 or 2000, I believe. And there was actually a lot of optimism surrounding his presidency at the very beginning. He was, you know, people thought or hoped that he would be a reformer. And he didn't kind of start to slide backwards into complete authoritarianism and dictatorship and brutality until further along down the road. So, and I think that, you know, you also saw this pattern with President Obama, who was trying to, you know, better relations with the Kremlin in the hopes that perhaps our you know, values would somewhere align somewhere, or foreign policy goals at least would align. But that, of course, has not been the case. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why people are so skeptical about President Trump's kind of affinity towards Vladimir Putin and questioning why he just will not criticize him at any point. I mean, last week we saw that the Russians came out and actually, you know, came out with a video simulating a nuclear strike on Florida, and we didn't hear a single
not a word.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, say if Kim Jong-un had done this, there would be angry tweets, there would be name calling. So it's just really kind of curious. And this new act in England, murdering a Russian national on British soil, is bound to just further drive a wedge between not only the UK and Russia, but also the UK and the US, if there's not a serious response from our part as well.
Well, there are, believe it or not, a couple more stories this week on this jammed week that I want to get to before we run out of too much time. And one of them is the fact that the Trump administration sued the state of California over its sanctuary policies. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions really blasted California for what he says, ignoring federal authority and, in Sessions' opinion, endangering the lives of ICE and other law enforcement officers. Here's the Attorney General speaking to the California Peace Officers Association in Sacramento on Wednesday.
California absolutely, it appears to me, is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So you can be sure I'm going to use every power I have to stop that.
Well, California Governor Jerry Brown was having none of that after the Attorney General made his remarks. Governor Jerry Brown called Sessions a liar.
It's not about the truth. It's not about protecting our state. It's about dividing America. And like so many in the Trump administration, this Attorney General has no regard for the truth. What he said earlier today is not true. It is a lie.
Now, for the record, PolitiFact fact-checked one of Sessions' claims that California bans its police from cooperating with ICE agents. And PolitiFact says that Sessions cherry-picked the facts, left out important details, and called the claim mostly false. Margaret Taliv, what's your take on this?
So California is like my home away from home, technically my home state, and worked there for many years, covered the California legislature and the governor. So this is like fascinating to me because on the one hand, it seems like Trump and Jeff Sessions, this is natural base messaging as well as what they believe. So what could go wrong? And yet on the other hand, this is sort of a win for every California Democrat with the race this year also because it's California. So even the Republicans in California, like for the most part, are more moderate, particularly they fall on the west side of the mountain chains that run up and down the state, more moderate than the collective Republican majority in Washington representing Congress. There is, as you know, and you may want to talk substance, but this is the politics of this overshadows all of the substance from my mind. This is a crucial midterm year. The path to Democrats' strategy for trying to take over, you know, the House runs through California. Half a dozen seats or so if they picked up could make a difference. And if you are a Democrat in California running for election this year, you want this fight. You definitely, definitely want this fight.
Bring people to the polls.
And so the attorney general and the president are taking a risk either because they believe in principle on it or because they believe that nationally it's an important message for them. They are taking the risk that this will that the good of this argument will outweigh the political risk in California.
Let's take a quick call on this. Nate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Nate.
Hi, thank you very much. I actually had a couple thoughts. One, when I first heard about this whole discussion as a federalism issue, I remember the federal law known as the Fugitive Slave Act, which slaveholders absolutely loved, but some free states actually worked against by doing things like enacting fees on people that cooperated with slave catchers. So even though they couldn't throw out the law itself, they could certainly hamper it. And with Gray Davis, Jerry Brown himself, I would happily trade governors with California. Now, grant that would make Wisconsin a lot less corrupt, and that's the main reason. But Jerry Brown is managing to both stand up for his state and say there are a group of people that, shockingly enough, ought to be treated like human beings.
Nate, thank you so much for your call. Jack Beatty, your response to that?
Well, you know, that's got some irony here because the Fugitive Slave Act was part of the price of the admission of California to the Union, the 31st star. And there were indeed no-go areas for slave catchers in Boston, Milwaukee, Chicago, other places. And we may be seeing something like that now.
But Jack, let me ask you, I mean, you know what many people are thinking right now. The Fugitive Slave Act had to do with human beings who were enslaved, whereas what we're talking about here right now regarding so-called sanctuary city or state laws are undocumented immigrants, and they just don't see the parallels. They don't think that it's a legitimate parallel.
Well, I can certainly see that. But, of course, at the time, slaves weren't citizens either. I think the parallel is local, people saying we're not going to follow the national law. We're going to defy it here.
Yeah. Well, let's get another call quickly. David is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, David.
Hi, Magna. I just wanted to say that what Sessions is trying to do is analogous to what Obama did when he cracked down on Arizona's crackdown on immigration, and you know he nullified the state laws there, and so I think California is going to have a hell of a time here. I think this is an end to sanctuary cities.
David, I'm going to just take it back from you there. Thank you so much for your call. Well, there's one more story I want to get to today in the last couple of minutes of the show here. Yeah, it's Michael Avenatti. He's the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, a porn star who allegedly had a sexual relationship with the president, or so she claims. Daniels filed a lawsuit in a Los Angeles court earlier this week, alleging that a non-disclosure agreement she made to keep quiet about an intimate relationship with the president is invalid because the president never signed it. Avenatti went on CNN Wednesday to explain why Daniels is filing the lawsuit.
My client wants an opportunity to tell her story, to tell the truth about what happened and what didn't happen, to tell the truth about the events not only relating to her relationship with the president, but also the conduct and what she's witnessed over the last 12 to 18 months as it relates to efforts to silence her.
Natasha Bertrand, I don't know what it means that we're ending this week with the Stormy Daniels story, but your thoughts on it. Natasha, go ahead.
Yeah, this could be potentially really dangerous for the president. I mean, depending on what Stormy and her lawyer actually have. You know, her lawyer has already kind of come out and said that this is a cover-up. He said the cover-up is that you have Trump's lawyer claiming that the president never knew anything about this, and that you have, you know, the White House also claiming the same thing. And he said specifically, he said explicitly, that's going to be shown to be patently false. They said that they have, you know, recordings, documents that show that the president was, in fact, very deeply involved in this. And of course, you saw Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, come out earlier this week and kind of annoy the president by acknowledging that this that he had been engaged in arbitration, kind of acknowledging that he was, in fact, very much involved in this. So, you know, it kind of, we have to see how it plays out. Legal experts disagree over how much vulnerability the president could actually have here, whether with regard to, you know, campaign finance mm-hmm. laws, whether those were violated, or whether or not it will come down to a deposition in which he, you know, is forced to, you know, testify about this and other kind of relationships that he may have tried to cover up. We just have to wait and see.
Margaret Talib, potentially dangerous for the president?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at this on two levels. And one is the legal liability or vulnerability, and the other is just the potential to undercut his political standing. Obviously, if President Trump had not won the election, this would not be a story. I just think it's important to remember that President Trump at this moment, and this has been true for a year now, is running for re-election and has counted strongly on the support of the evangelical voting community, as well as kind of mainstream Republicans on Capitol Hill. And although some of the details of precisely what the relationship were may still be in doubt, it is not in doubt that there was that they knew each other, that they had met and spent time together, and that there was then subsequently legal maneuvering to keep that fact out of the press.
But Margaret, can I just stop here for a quick second? We just got a minute or so to go. I mean, your point about evangelical voters, I mean, haven't we seen recently, I mean, Roy Moore in Alabama and even the allegations against the president when he was running in 2016, that they're rather impervious to the effects of these stories and their support for Trump Republicans?
That has certainly been the case because of the nomination of conservative judicial nominees and some other factors, some other policies that the president has pursued or said that he would pursue. All I'm saying is that there are two levels on which the story exists. And one is the question of, were there campaign finance violations and what does that mean for the president? But the other is just the specter of the president, the most important office in the world, having had this as part of his orbit and what that means for Trump himself and for America.
Right. Well, Jack, the last 30 seconds or so today goes to you.
Well, I do notice that Steve Bannon, in Fire and Fury, says this, that, quote, Trump's lawyers took care of 100 women during the presidential campaign. Well, let's say that's Bannonian hyperbole. Let's make it 10 women. He's going to be asked about this in any deposition related to Stormy Daniels. Stay tuned.
Well, what a week in the news it has been, and I'm going to hazard a guess that it's probably going to be just as intense next week as well. So, On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Magda.
And Natasha Bertrand, staff writer at The Atlantic covering national security, thank you so very much as well.
Thanks, Magda.
And Margaret Talib, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. It was great to talk with you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magda.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us at Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.